fabric, and they will serve their village as well. Other villages, I'm afraid, are not in that situation, and no action is just not an option, I don't think, for those villages. To return to what I said before, I think that no matter what structure or no matter what option we structure or what option or structure a village chooses to use, the only thing that is going to protect that village into the future is diligence and perseverance on the part of those village members. I mean, they're going to have to watch what's going on. They're going to have to pay attention to what is happening, not only to them in their village, but also to the village corporation, the corporation structures within state and federal law. It's going to be an ongoing duty and burden to, you know, keep observing what is happening so that essentially they don't end up getting worked into a corner. And I think that despite all of our moving towards trying to find the bomb-proof structure and developing lots of different options, I think that the only thing that is going to ensure that lands which village corporations or the Native corporations received under the Claims Act remains in Native hands is a true dedication by those Natives involved that is what's going to happen. I think that with that basic dedication by the people involved, I think that we can orchestrate and build structures that will let it happen. But without that basic dedication, I'm afraid no structure is going to protect them and carry them forward.
Yeah, we looked at the for-profit corporation, the non-profit, the cooperative, the IRA, and to use Elizabeth's expression, I hope I won't get shot for this, but in December we're bringing some people here from the lower 48 and from other countries to talk about the devices they've used, the legal mechanisms they've used. Maybe none of these alternatives that we've discussed is adequate. Let's see what other people around the world are doing. And it's important enough to make sure we look at all of those alternatives. Rosemary, you're next.
I really appreciate the opportunity to come here because I haven't participated very much, but I have learned a lot just by listening. The Doyon region has very few IRAs. They are mostly traditional councils. And I would like to point out that it's very important to get all the questions out before you act, because I learned the hard way. The state told the community of Northway that there was money available for community projects at the unincorporated community aid, and that the village councils did not qualify for that money, even though Northway is 80% Native people and 20% white. They were not incorporated, so they didn't qualify for the money. So they said we had to set up a nonprofit corporation for this money specifically, which we did. And then some more money came along from the state, and they said, okay, we no longer recognize the village council. The nonprofit is the only corporation we will recognize for state money. So there are twists that you have to look at before you act. And now the traditional council is upset with me as the president of the nonprofit. But we try to work together. We have a standing resolution that we will not take any money if the village council wishes. The corporation can say, we don't want money, but we want the village council to have this money. So it's important to look at all the issues before you act.
Yeah, I think we can all say amen to that. Evelyn Hash-Pete, you badly want to say something? You can take Paul's seat there and use that microphone if you wish.
I'd like to see that the framework of what all of you are talking about is already in place, and that we have seen two ice ages, and this government we're talking about has been in effect and in practice. That the Land Claim Settlement Act has a section called Valid Existing Rights, which means all rights prior to statehood, prior to Columbus, prior to Adam and Eve, which in our language we call recent history. those governments that have been in existence for these many, many, many thousands of years is the law. We are the law. And when I say, I'm always saying, the law of the land shall prevail. That's just what I mean. All of these things that have been used to fool us for how many years now? 200 years? In the last 40 years or 30 years? The Land Claim Settlement Act and all of these things that they just keep sending on each single issue. Go to court, settle it in court on each single issue. But we already have our own laws as Native people, and we still own Alaska. We still have our traditional borders, and this is all nice. I'm glad you're talking about it, but the truth is, the law of the land shall prevail. Thank you.
Thank you. Just before we adjourn for lunch, I know some of you are leaving, and I want to thank all of you who can't return after lunch for coming, and to say that if you're still in town, we're having a reception at the commission offices at 5, and everybody, of course, at the round table is invited, and all the folks in the audience are invited too. That's at 5 o'clock this afternoon at our office, which is at 429 D Street. Sorry. 429 D Street. Well, anyway, I think just about everybody knows where it is, and you're invited at 5 for a reception there. Could I thank Bart again for his paper? And if I may thank now all the attorneys. I mean, we all go in for this attorney bashing. It's not just Alaska, it's everywhere, and they take it in pretty good humor. But all of the attorneys here have been well, I was one, and then I became a judge, and now I'm an attorney again. I'm just kind of getting used to the. But I think that all the attorneys here have laid it on the line and haven't pulled their punches, and that really helps. It helps me, and it should help all of you. Look, this afternoon when we come back, we can continue, and I hope that I'll be here, and I hope that that Dan and Elizabeth will be here to talk about how you get these things from the corporation over to X, wherever it's going, and I hope Elizabeth will talk about some of the problems regarding corporate disclosure, proxy solicitation, because she's the great expert on the state on the subject, and I want to find out more about that. And so it's 10 to 1. Why don't we come back at 2:15, and we'll carry on from then until we go to the reception. Just take our seats. Well, maybe we could get underway again. I've got a some of the participants can't be back this afternoon, so I think we'll start now. Just a couple of announcements. I'll remind you again of the reception at the Commission's office, 5 o'clock this afternoon, to which you are all, of course, invited. The footnotes to Bart Garber's paper are available at the desk at the back. You'll recall that when he presented his paper, he said the footnotes would be coming, and they are here, and so you can pick up the footnotes there. And some people have asked about transcripts of what's been said at this meeting, and I'm told the transcripts will be available by Christmas, which means if you would want to order them, just send an order in writing to the Alaska Native Review Commission, and I think you would get those transcripts early in the new year. So I think that we are now in a position to return to the discussion, and it seemed to me that we had looked at these possibilities, transferring land from from native corporations to the land bank, to nonprofits, to cooperatives, and to IRAs, and even to traditional councils. And I think that it might be a good idea, if you don't mind, if we go back to a couple of questions that it seems to me should not be forgotten. And one is, can the corporations do this? What kind of a vote, what kind of a mandate do they need from their shareholders, et cetera, et cetera? We discussed this yesterday morning when we talked about the first of the AFN resolutions. It may be worth returning to for a minute or two. And then after that, we'll ask Elizabeth to talk about, well, when you go to get that mandate, what do you have to tell the people? And recent legislation in Alaska, some lawsuits apparently shed light on that subject. And let's just cover that particular ground before we run out of time. So if you don't mind, I think we've all kicked these entities around, and let's go on from there. Dan and Elizabeth, anything further you want to say about obtaining a mandate from the shareholders to transfer land or other assets? You talked about this earlier, a major corporate event, an organic change, and so on and so forth. Anything in light of what was said this morning that should be mentioned? Perhaps you might just repeat the basic themes.
Okay, the basic themes I tried to talk about before were, since whether we're talking about a continuation of restrictions on stock, whether we're talking about a merger of the corporation with some other entity, whether we're talking about a transfer of all of the assets, or in some of the villages' cases, what would be substantially all of the assets to another entity, these are major, significant corporate events. What Dan Fessler referred to, I believe it was yesterday, as organic changes. And these are the kinds of events that the board could not do on its own. The board would act first to vote on what to take to the shareholders, and then the shareholders themselves would vote on the choices. I think that not only is that the thrust of corporate law, but I think it is really the thrust of the promise that's been made by the native leaders to their shareholders, that this would happen. The second thing, though, in that step, which it becomes a crucial question, is once your shareholders are voting, and of course they're voting by numbers of shares, what numbers of shares it takes to pass something. And if you are dealing with just normal corporate matters, it really usually just takes a majority of those present by person or by proxy. If, however, you're dealing with a major corporate event, there are different statutes you would look to tell you what the standards were for passage. When the Native community wanted to make it easier to achieve mergers, they sought and got from Congress a provision on mergers which said that the vote for approving mergers was a majority of the outstanding shares, a middle ground. Some of the Alaska state statutes for certain events require two-thirds of the outstanding shares. In terms of anti-takeover devices, when you're trying to prevent something, when you as the corporation and shareholders all agree you're trying to prevent something, you can have supermajority standards too. So there are a whole range of possible standards, and that becomes an important important question.
David Case.
These requirements are spelled out by statute, correct? Are there any common law requirements of a similar nature, or is it all statutory?
In the area of disclosure, I'm aware of common law requirements, but not so much in this other area.
Okay, Dolly Garza.
So for something major, does it require that two-thirds vote?
Under state law, yes, but I think one of the things as one considers options and trying to craft legislation that you could consider is having, you know, a lesser standard than two-thirds, because as Charlie, I believe it was pointed out yesterday, that in some of the Native corporations, to get even a 50% participation is a very difficult thing, much less to get 50% all voting the same way. So you on one hand, you have sort of a reality pushing you, and on the other hand, you have what is good corporate governance, not to set your standards so low that if Liz Johnston just votes alone, that's what happens, and you'd never want that, incidentally. That's it.
When you talk about 50%, do you mean 50% of the warm bodies or 50% of the
I use two
proxies?
I use two terms, and they're different from each other. One, I use the term majority of those present by person or by proxy. That's what it takes to just do the run-of-the-mill things. And then I use the phrase majority of the outstanding shares, and of course that means if there were 500,000 shares issued in Bristol Bay, it would take 250,000 plus one voting yes for a major change, if that were the standard.
250,000 present plus, in person or by proxy?
Yes.
So you could theoretically have Liz Johnston there with all the proxies?
Oh, yes.
And that's all you'd need?
Yes, but it's just, you can see that's a higher standard.
Oh, yes, yes.
Okay, that's yes, but mechanically, okay. No, some people have a lot of trouble there. I'm sorry.
David Case.
Are dissenters' rights in this same category of requirements in order to make changes, the same category as these voting requirements you mentioned?
Okay. Historically, when you went back in corporate law, you had a system where if you were going to make major organic changes, it took everybody voting the same way. And what happened was, there would be, you know, 99 people wanting to go one way and one guy saying, ha, have I got a deal, I'm going to hold you up. Now, if you'll just kick me under the table, 5,000, 10,000, whatever it is, sweetheart, I'll vote the way you want me to. And so corporate law changed so there couldn't be any holdup to reduce it from 100% voting one way to two-thirds or, you know, some lesser standard. But in order to balance then what happens to those who are legitimate people with a legitimate desire to go a different way, they put in dissenters' rights. It was a balancing effort. And in Alaska state statutes, dissenters' rights do exist for certain types of events. If you were under just Alaska state law, it would be you would have dissenters' rights in the merger area. You would have dissenters' rights in the sale of all or substantially all of the assets.
And again, these are exclusively statutory requirements. There is no such thing as a common law dissenters' right?
I hesitate to answer that one. I don't know the answer.
Well, they're there anyway in the statute.
Yes, definitely.
They're in the statute. Now, a question was raised earlier in a discussion between David Case and Elizabeth and myself about could you simply, by amending the Articles of Incorporation of an existing Alaska profit-seeking corporation, sort of transmute it into a cooperative corporation?
Convert it.
Convert it.
Whatever.
Whatever. All right. Now, that's a specific question, and you would think that by consulting the laws of Alaska, we should be able to give you a specific answer. I will now read you the law. The law is found in Section 10, Chapter 5, 207 of the revised Alaska statutes. The right to amend, this is the existing law, the right to amend the Articles of Incorporation. Corporation may amend its Articles of Incorporation from time to time in any and as many respects as may be desired, comma, so long as its Articles of Incorporation as amended contain provisions which might be lawfully contained in the original Articles of Incorporation at the time the amendment is made, comma, and, comma, if the change in shares or rights of shareholders or an exchange or reclassification or cancellation of shares or rights of shareholders is to be made, provisions necessary to effect the change, exchange, reclassification, or cancellation. Now, what does that mean? Well, the biggest question, it seems to me, is it would not be legal to organize a corporate entity under Chapter 5 of Article 10 as a cooperative. If you want to organize a corporate entity as a cooperative, you do that under Chapter 15.
Which is
the cooperative statute. So when the statute says a corporation may amend its articles from time to time, so long as its articles of incorporation as amended contain provisions which might be lawfully contained in the original articles of incorporation, you could not have such provisions lawfully in the original articles of incorporation of any entity formed under Chapter 5. So I think in order to become a cooperative, one would have to go through the more tedious process of setting the cooperative up as a corporate entity under Chapter 15 of the statutes and then merging the existing Chapter 5 corporation into the Chapter 15 corporation. That would require observance of the procedures for an organic change, and it would appear to entail the recognition of dissenters' rights. That would be the most conservative That would be the worst case scenario.
So to the question, can you convert a native corporation into a cooperative, the answer is no.
Well, I'm sorry, I do have think I, there's another I, statute.
Okay, you
there is another statutory provision, and I can't cite it to you. But it's either in the cooperative provisions or another provision of the profit-making corporate code. I can only say I read it, and maybe I have misread it, and I wouldn't.
And the gist of which
you gist of which is you can convert. It's a special provision to convert a profit corporation into a cooperative with a two-thirds vote by amending the Articles of Incorporation.
Well, there is no question that you can. Well, I don't know of anyone that talks about converting it. You can clearly change if you observe the two-thirds voting requirement. You can effectuate the organic change to merge or consolidate with and have the resulting corporation be a cooperative corporation.
Yeah, that's correct. And the only difference I can see in the other provision, which I can't recall, is that there were no dissenters' rights specified. That's why I was interested in as to whether there was such a thing as a common law dissenters' right.
I don't know, and I am simply unaware, but would not deny the potential existence of such a statute. I don't know of such a statute.
Okay, that's not probably the point.
Isn't in those AFN opinions, those legal opinions, wasn't there some reference made to it there? Is that where you're? I see. And Elizabeth, you're not aware of such a provision either, eh?
I'm not aware of such a provision, but that doesn't mean David's not correct.
No, at all.
It just means it's true. I'm not aware of such a provision.
Yeah. I guess that, you know, with folks such as you, I'm not going to say that I'm right.
Why not? It happens to me in the office all the time.
Well, does that we spent a lot of time yesterday on this question of the mandate from the shareholders. Could we move on and ask Elizabeth to talk about Sorry, Dan, go ahead.
There's one point that we ought not to lose track of. If the statute that you're referring to is in existence, fine. If it is not in existence or does not have the content that memory serves, then should it be thought advantageous and determined advantageous by you as the clients to have such a provision, then the very body that either has or has not created such a statute exists, and it's sitting right down there in Juneau, and you've got an agenda of something to ask them for. That certainly doesn't require an act of Congress.
Yeah. Well, I think that point is well taken, Ralph.
I just want to come back a little bit more global. One thing that was not repeated this morning in that context, and that is that the corporate form and the co-op form are the products of and are protected by and are articulated by state law. If the state legislature should change character as the state becomes more urban over the next 10, 15, 20, 30 years, then the legislature can change the rules of the game, and one then has to decide whether the forum of the state legislature is better than the forum of the Congress of the United States. And I don't want to make a big play of that now, but a lot that certainly is a background factor to keep in mind. I can assure you that the people in the state of Washington, the Indians in the state of Washington, would much prefer, infinitely prefer, to deal with Congress than with the legislature of the state of Washington. I can't say that that's true here. I know the population percentage of natives here is much greater, the economic power is much greater, that sort of thing. But in the state of Washington, the state legislature has not demonstrated any receptiveness to Indian concerns. So.
And the public has recently, by a slim margin, voted against the perpetuation of the rights conferred by the Bolt decision, I understand.
That's exactly right. An initiative was passed by the people of the state of Washington to overturn the Bolt decision. The initiative is unconstitutional, but it does indicate what the majority of the people of the state of Washington, informed or uninformed, did. Congress won't do that. Congress won't go along with it, but the state of Washington did.
Well, it may be that out of all of this, and we're not here to pass a resolution or to make up our minds, but I think this menu that we've got laid before us, given we might in the end have a situation in which it seems right that Alaska Natives should, some of them, be able to choose the cooperative. Others might choose IRA. Others might say, we'll take our chances with a for-profit corporation right down the line. Others might do this. Others might do that. But at least we're gaining an idea of what has to be done in Juneau and in Washington to make that range of choices available to people. And with 7 years to work on it, I would think these problems are not overwhelming. Rose Marie.
Yes, we're going to have to be leaving about 3:30, and I was wondering if we could get into the discussion that I don't remember the gentleman down here wanted to talk about conflict of interest and also with proxies, because we'll be leaving in about half an hour.
Okay. Could we, if you could, Elizabeth, could you deal with proxies then, and then we'll try to deal with conflict of interest, if that's okay? You.
Okay, I think that everyone here is experienced with the idea that when you are going to hold a shareholders meeting, that you can hold a shareholders meeting not only involving the people that are physically present at that meeting, but also by proxy, by someone else giving the proxy holder the power to vote for them. And this is generally the way you're able to get a sufficient amount of participation in your meeting to go ahead. BB&C has 5,300 shareholders. They are located.
How many?
5,300. Oh, mm-hmm. They are located only 60% within the region, 40% outside. They're located all over. Having proxies is obviously a very convenient device. At the same time, when you are going out to go solicit proxies, there are certain things that should be told the shareholders. How you're going to vote the proxy, perhaps, is a useful thing. Before the proxy regulations were in place, I remember very vividly within the Bristol Bay region, a lady who was a dissident, and she solicited 70,000 shares, which is a nice round number. And then she discovered that her own son was running on the management slate. Those were by power substitution signed over to the son. I would like to that much to the surprise, I assure you, of the people who had given that lady their proxies, because of course they wanted to vote against the management slate. That was the whole purpose. I think under the set of proxy regulations, that would not be appropriate. You must talk with people, frankly, and in above board fashion, what you're going to do with their proxy. And you show this to them, and you don't bring something up cute at the annual, you don't run out and solicit a lot of proxies and then bring up a new subject at the annual meeting and then use the proxies in a way you've not let people know that's going to happen. It's just an issue of fair play. So in the area of voting for directors, you reveal to people a little background about the directors, and you reveal to people who you're going to vote for. In the area when you get in terms of proposals, however, before the annual meeting, that often gets more complex because there's a lot of discussion about what you must reveal. And of course, if you're in the position of management soliciting, you have an even heavier burden because you have the responsibilities of the annual report too. I remember Larry Carroll shared this with me. There was one corporation who wanted to continually have everybody come and vote for me, vote for me, vote for me. I'm wonderful management. Oh, by the way, you'll get your annual report after the annual meeting is over. I assure you, if I did that to you, you might vote for me, but if you saw the results of my management, you might not. So management has an additional burden of making sure that the annual report is out and shows that to people. But when you're actually—
Before any proxies are solicited by
Before any proxies are solicited by management, there's one exception to that, which would be if a dissident group starts soliciting, okay? Management doesn't have to sit back and wait.
Can I just intervene?
Yeah.
I notice dissident is always used to describe those who oppose management.
Right.
Is that a term of art, or is it something that's crept into the vocabulary?
It's probably crept into the vocabulary, and it is probably a preferable term for me to use in lieu of what I might use as a member of management. So I mean it, however, as a descriptive term. I could talk about a non-management slate if that would be an appropriate.
No, carry on.
Okay. In general, I agree with you with the idea that management must send out an annual report. In other words, show people where they are, what they're doing, how they've performed before they solicit proxies. There's one exception to that rule, which is if the dissident or non-management slate were to begin soliciting much earlier, management is not required to sit there until they can put their annual report together before they go out and solicit too. The proxy rules are not set up to create a distorted advantage to one side or the other. The harder area, however, actually, for telling shareholders what's going on in the annual meeting is when you get to specific proposals, which of course is the area we've really been talking about for 2.5 days. Specific proposals presented to the shareholders that they would vote on that would not be advisory but that would be mandatory and that would strengthen or weaken, that would alter or keep the same the entities that they're now dealing with. And I urge you to think in terms of that when you do present these to your shareholders, that you should take great care in disclosing to them the consequences of the choices before them. Although, as Glenn pointed out, the discussions in the last 2.5 days have talked a lot about things that are uncertain. They've talked about different entities having certain positive things and certain negative things. I don't think there's any entity we've talked about that you couldn't say there were certain positive things to be gained by this and certain negative things. I think that bearing that in mind, that it would be very important that whatever choices each of you ultimately ends up doing with presenting to, for your shareholders' consideration, at a real vote where we're talking about an operative meeting now of shareholders, that you would lay out for them the pluses and minuses. In other words, don't slip into the salesman's routine where you say, this is the greatest thing since sliced bread. The trail of Native corporations is strewn with the bodies of Native corporation management that tried to do that. In some cases, the corporations have been able then to change management and carry on in a more productive way, and I would mention the Aleuts as an example of that. They had a very early case, and it was under common law, even before the proxy regulations were in place, that talked about the fact that there must be truth-telling to shareholders about management's representations. But a more recent case, and a more, if you like, disastrous or costly case, I would almost say a no-win case, was the Koniec case. As many of us know, it was dragged through the court system for years. It ended up in literally millions of dollars in attorney's fees. And I would like to think that Koniec will recover from that lawsuit, but I don't know that they will. And so I think that not just the pure heart, true, start with the pure heart, the idea that if you're presenting choices to your shareholders, they have a right to know between those two choices what would be the pluses and minuses about staying where you are, what would be the pluses and minuses about the new choice. For example, we talked, and I'm only going to use as one example, but it's one that's bothered me, which is we know right now we've got corporations with kind of a cluster of membership. I mentioned that at BB&C, some people live even outside the region. So we've got a tremendous pattern of a range of where people live. We also know at present at BB&C, we've got both Native and non-Native membership, although the non-Native membership is a very low figure today. Okay, suppose we were to switch over and present to the shareholders the choice of an IRA. I think it would be very important then to make sure and not only have established the way we've all been talking about so that it's clear who would be the members of the IRA, but you would make sure that that was told to your membership so that if you were suddenly switching from a system where people who did or did not reside in, or where everybody, no matter where they resided, the mobility thing that Bart was addressing applied, as opposed to the IRA situation where maybe mobility is not the same thing. Whatever the rules are, just help your shareholders see the pluses and minuses of each choice and don't shade it by your own preferences. And the Koniec lawsuit, as I say, it's been disastrous in the sense of what it's the end result of it, because management did not reveal a couple of things. They were important things. Again, it was not that anybody was particularly applying securities laws, but those were certainly used by way of analogy. And what happened was indeed a positive, perhaps, change in Koniec management, but only after bleeding the corporation dry. And I suppose in this sense I'm at one with Dan Fessler by saying nothing beats preventive law. And I think that if you can realize just that you're taking a major proposal to the shareholders and can make sure that you get help in thinking through and making sure you list for them the differences between the two choices. It's just an extremely important step, and again, it's a fair step.
Could I ask a question, John Taylor and then David Case, but before either of you, could I ask a question of Elizabeth? These choices are going to be made by the shareholders, and they are choices that may have far-reaching implications for future generations of Native people. And we've all been talking about, well, making those choices within the present corporate structure. Management makes a proposal, another group opposed to management may make a proposal. They go around competing for proxies, come to the meeting, and vote the, well.
I think if the competing group made a proposal, you'd have a problem, because if you're talking about an organic change, usually that comes out of the board of directors. What you would have to follow your scenario, what you would have to have is a change of the board for the competing proposal to come forward.
Okay. All right. So you've got a proposal from the board, but some may
with choices.
Yeah. With choices.
Yeah.
Yes. Suppose the board said, "Do you want to go IRA? Do you want to go co-op? Do you want to do this or stay corporation, or put so much land in?" Or suppose it was perfectly straightforward. We've got.
It's got to be if you're going to count the votes, because your suggestion would mean you never end up with the right affirmative votes to go anywhere.
Okay.
You know, it would be like, do you want A or do you want B
okay.
to be able to do it right?
All right. Let's say, do you want A or do you want B? Now, you turn up at the meeting and there are maybe 100 shareholders in person, and they have a majority of proxies one way or the other. Okay, now this may sound heretical, but and it's not provided for under the law. But since these people, these shareholders, are making a very important decision, some is it morally appropriate even to consider a referendum ballot? Now I know that's not necessarily done, but
I tell you,
that is where you had a ballot box in each community. And
okay. I would be very concerned about the control of the ballot box in each community.
Oh, yeah.
But let me answer what
okay.
I think is your concern. If a proxy is prepared properly, when you're dealing with a major proposal for shareholders, they're really two sets of documents that go out. One is the proxy statement, where there's all the verbiage and all the explanation. And the other is the card itself. And if you're giving shareholders a major choice, let's say it's just proposal number one, yes or no. You know, yes, we want to keep the corporate structure. You know, yes, we want to go IRA. I mean, those are the two clear choices. There is a place on the proxy card for people to vote, and that becomes a directed proxy. So the proxy holder who has that proxy, you know, let's say I become the proxy holder, I can't vote that proxy any way I want. I must vote it the way that shareholder marked it. Okay, so that becomes, I believe, the equivalent of what you're suggesting.
Yeah, that's the equivalent of a mail ballot.
That's exactly
yeah.
right. And it
yeah.
just is, it really is on a proposal issue that this happens. That's much harder to do when you're dealing with directors and cumulative voting, which is why you see a lot more verbiage clustered around that. But when you're dealing with proposals, you definitely not only can have, but should have, a directed ballot or a directed proxy, which is the equivalent of
yeah.
a vote.
Well, I'm glad I asked that question. John Taylor, and then David and Tony.
Elizabeth, Daniel, there's some other issues embedded in what you've been talking about that I think may be of interest to us right here. Under the proposed new legislation that you helped put together, Dan, and what you were talking about, Elizabeth, there's some shifts in the deadlines for proxies and proxy statements and getting voter lists out and getting access to shareholder lists. There's also some changes in the lengths of times, I believe, that we're playing with here. The real question is, assuming that we're going to have corporations surviving beyond 1991, might there not be some differences that we may want to look look at in those timelines and different management options as to when they have to start doing some of this to be in a much more protective position than we are right now? I know under the new corporate statutes, we've got a little more leeway, and there's some differences there. But the question always comes up, for instance, in cumulative, non-cumulative voting, there may have to be a switch to protect, you know, now we're trying to look out for minorities issues sometimes. We may want to turn around and put it all to protect the majority. How about in this proxy area? Are there are some areas that we ought to look at that we may want to shift into a little later on?
That is really a tough question for me to answer. As I tried to think through, as you know, in talking to me, I've always thought of the belt and suspenders approach, which is we would do certain things in federal law, and at the same time, we would do certain things in state law so that if anyone failed, something else would cover us. And all I meant was I in terms of looking at the state law issue, I had only looked really at a narrow number of options that are traditional in the anti-takeover area, such as supermajorities, such as making sure that if someone owned more than 100 shares, that it wouldn't be one share, one vote. Those are the two, ability to change your articles so that when you were considering mergers, you could consider non-monetary considerations. Anyway, in some ways, I know these words are just rolling off people's backs. All I'm suggesting to you, John, is that I had never really, I don't have an answer for you because I'd never sat back and analyzed a change in these other aspects and how that would work.
Well, some of Dan's new proposals in the new proposed corporate statutes do make some significant shifts in the timelines. And I'm just wondering whether, Dan, you've had a chance to think through